How far was Nelson's leadership responsible for victory against the French at sea?
The Royal Navy was always going to defeat the French in the long wars between 1793 and 1815 because it had a far higher calibre of leadership at all levels, from petty officers right through to fleet admirals. It had more professional, skilled men in all the key positions. The French had destroyed their naval leadership. They'd executed their admirals, they'd murdered their captains, and handed over the ships to anybody who fancied taking command. They'd renamed all of their ships, which is bad luck as well, for radical and unpleasant Republican themes. They had one called Tyrannicide. These are not ships that encourage your loyalty. One of them had a guillotine on the quarterdeck just to make sure that people understood what the agenda was. So the Royal Navy, thoroughly professional, experienced, with a long track record of winning at sea against a French Navy that's essentially committed suicide and then risen from the dead to try and fight. Nelson ends up as the inspirational figure, and he is the man who commands at three of the great battles that really do make a tremendous difference. And he's exemplary. He is an example of the best of what the Royal Navy has. He doesn't single-handedly win the war. His leadership isn't the one thing that makes a big difference. There were other very, very good officers. This was a golden generation. Both Nelson's generation and the generation that followed him were full of brilliant men. But what Nelson does is provide a figurehead. He has a genius for war. His insight into the weather, the ocean, what the enemy can do, his ability to read the context, to process the intelligence, as we would call it, is absolutely second to none. He anticipates, for example, Napoleon going to Egypt. He anticipates him so brilliantly he gets there before Napoleon and is somewhat puzzled to find that Napoleon isn't there. And so he goes off and has a look to make sure he hasn't made a mistake, which is why he comes back after Napoleon lands. He got there early. The Egyptians said, we haven't seen any Frenchmen. Why do you think they're coming here? What his leadership ultimately is about is making all the big decisions and making the job of his subordinates relatively straightforward. Nelson knew that in a fleet battle, one English ship would take a French ship in about an hour. Simple attritional maths. The English fired faster, more accurately, they would kill more Frenchmen. The Frenchmen would have to surrender. So what he needed to do was to break up the French fleet into individual pieces, to destroy their cohesion, to take out their command and control, take their admiral, their cohesion out of the battle. So they were just individual pieces wandering around, which could be taken one at a time. This was the way to speed up battle. So at Trafalgar, we know that he was commanding a fleet, many of the captains of which he'd never met before. So he had very quickly to brief these men, to make them understand how he wanted to fight, what he wanted to achieve, and what he expected them to do in battle. It's very interesting that he picked his great friend Cuthbert Collingwood to lead the second attack, because Collingwood had known Nelson for 35 years. They were as close as brothers, so they understood each other very well. And behind the Victory, he put the ships that he knew he could rely on. Victory, Temeraire, and then Neptune, commanded by Thomas Fremantle, who he'd served all the way through the Revolutionary Napoleonic Wars with. He knew and trusted Fremantle above all others. He knew that in a fight, Fremantle was somebody he could absolutely rely on. So he front loads his fleet with people that he trusts, and he hopes the others will be encouraged. But the attack at Trafalgar sums up what Nelson is all about. The French and Spanish fleet is at sea, it's heading for Sicily, it sees Nelson coming, it reverses course to head back to Cadiz in safety. Nelson has very little time to attack and defeat it. The wind is light, they're moving at around 2 miles an hour. So this is a slow walking pace battle. So at sunup on the 21st of October, the fleets are in sight, but it's midday before they start shooting. So everybody has a long time to think about what's going to happen. What Nelson does is to form his force rapidly into two columns for a direct attack, which is without parallel as a specific piece of tactical development. This is highly risky because battleships of this period only fire to the side. So by going bow on towards the enemy, you're allowing all of them to fire at you when you can't even fire back. But Nelson has to do this because he knows there's a storm coming later that day, and this is the only chance he'll get. He has to destroy these people now, otherwise it'll be years before they're found at sea again. So he sacrifices the safety of the fleet, but particularly his flagship, which is leading, in order to speed up the attack, and he settles on the point of attack when Villeneuve shows his flag. He will take out the enemy's command and control in the first move of the battle, and the enemy fleet will then be this collection of pieces which his fleet will take or destroy in relatively quick time. He predicts that they will take 20 of the enemy's 33 battleships. Final score was 19. So it wasn't a prediction, it was a very accurate assessment. And they do that because Nelson breaks the enemy's force. He takes out Villeneuve. The Victory fires a full broadside into the stern gallery of Villeneuve's flagship, the Bucentauri, which leaves the ship completely wrecked. Villeneuve can't get off the ship. He has no boats. He can't signal. He has no signal equipment. He has no officers left. The ship can't fight because half the guns have been knocked over. It's a completely useless piece around which the battle then develops. What Nelson has done is set up, as he calls it, a pell-mell battle. Close quarters, rapid broadsides, the very battle that the English will do best at. And then as the English ships come in, the French ships and the Spanish ships start to surrender. That's exemplary leadership. And before they start to fight, Nelson flies that famous signal, England expects that every man will do his duty. What he actually meant to say, and what the fleet understood him to have said, was Nelson trusts that every man will do his duty. Expect sounds a little like I'm not sure you will. Nelson knew they would. And when he flies England, the men on the ships aren't thinking of England. They're thinking about the Admiral. And this is the first time in naval history that an Admiral has sent a message to every man in the fleet, because they've now got a signalling system that will allow them to spell out things like England expects. Only a few years before, the signals were just about moving the ships. Now they can actually send verbal messages. The whole fleet cheers at this point. They're absolutely entranced. Nelson has walked around the Victory and he's talked to the crew and he's given them that kind of lifting, morale-boosting speech. But he's now found a vehicle to transmit that to 26 other ships. And everybody is absolutely beside themselves. And he's doing what he's been doing throughout his career. He's building a mythology of genius, of heroism, of daring, and of success. He famously said, "I've been wounded 100 times in the King's service." He fought only once without being wounded. And that was at Copenhagen, where everybody else got wounded. He had some terrible injuries, but he kept on going. And he stood out there in the place where everybody could see him. He wasn't being brave. He was doing his job. The Admiral had to stand there in the most dangerous place because everybody else took the cue from him. If he ran, everybody else would run. If he went out of harm's way, everybody else would follow. So it's a very public display of courage. And he's done it over and over again. He knows it's going to hurt. You know, he knows it. He's not going to get through the day without something bad happening. Does he flinch? Does he hell? So he's eventually killed by a random piece of ammunition flying around. But he lives. It's still not clear how he lives. He lives long enough to know that they won this great victory. And then as he drifts off, he says, "Thank God I've done my duty." That's his mantra. And he's clearly thought about what his last words should be. He's also got it on a loop until he just drifts off. And that leadership is captured by the state. When Nelson's body is brought home, he lays in state in the Painted Hall at Greenwich, the Royal Naval Hospital, and thousands come to pay their respects to Nelson. And then he comes in this great river pageant from Greenwich to Whitehall Stairs. He's then overnight in the Admiralty Building. And then he goes from the Admiralty Building down the Strand, past the Temple Bar, into the City of London, where he's now under the command of the Lord Mayor of London, not the British state. And he's buried in St. Paul's, which is the cathedral of the City of London, because the people who valued Nelson most were the City of London. He's the one who saved their trade, their commerce, their prosperity. And he's then laid to rest under the crossing of the church, literally right at the very centre of the church design. They open the floor and lower Nelson's coffin into the crypt, where he's placed under a huge sarcophagus made for Cardinal Wolsey, beautiful piece of red porphyry, and he is at the epicentre of a pantheon of heroic British dead. The two captains who fell at Trafalgar are there as his retainers, and then you wander out into the rest of the crypt, and there they all are. Collingwood is there, Wellington is there, and many another. The King has a large role in deciding that Nelson shall be buried in this way. And the effect, ultimately, is to turn Nelson from a dead hero into an immortal. He's buried like a Roman god. He is the war hero, the war god of the British state. As Byron says, Britannia's god of war. So he is more than a man who led the ships at Trafalgar. He is the exemplary figure who unites and bolsters a war effort. In 1805, you know, it didn't look good. The Prime Minister was dying. The King was intermittently insane. Nobody had heard of any British generals who'd won any battles. And Napoleon was ruling the whole of Europe. And so the spirit of Nelson becomes the spirit of the country. He is this titanic figure. And 30 years later, they raise the column in Trafalgar Square at the behest of the Duke of Wellington, who signed off on the final design. And the design in Trafalgar Square, we forget what it means. We talk of Nelson's column, and that's the thing that matters. The statue doesn't matter. The statue is there for people who don't understand architectural history. The column is a replica of the columns in the Roman Temple of Mars in the Augustan Forum. The Temple of Mars, the god of war, was built by Augustus to celebrate the deification of Julius Caesar, who was the son of Mars, and the establishment of an empire that would last forever following Augustus's vengeance on Caesar's killers. So Nelson's column says, "We are the masters of the universe, and if you don't know why, there's a statue on top." All of the other decoration is effectively superfluous. The column itself is a history lesson. It's an imperial statement in stone. And people who've had a little bit of artistic and architectural training recognize this. Hitler knew exactly what it was. He said it's the totem pole of the British Empire. He said, "And when I conquer London, I will take it back." Didn't happen. So Nelson becomes more than a war leader. He becomes an iconic national figure, the unifying, codifying exemplar of what it meant to be a British hero. And his leadership on the field of battle is outstanding, but his leadership as an iconic national figure is even more important. The only people in Britain who ever complained about Nelson were people who wanted the war to stop and us to do a deal with the French. Charles James Fox and the Whig Party. If you look at James Gilray's first cartoon, published after the Battle of the Nile, it's not about the battle, it's Charles James Fox and his mates crying into their beer that their political plan to do a deal with the French has been spoiled by Nelson. They hated him. You know, he made the war successful. They wanted it to be unsuccessful. They wanted peace. Nelson kept the war going, and he kept it going to the end because it was his disciples, his followers, who finished the war off. The man who burnt down the White House in Washington was Sir George Cockburn, was one of his protégés. Cockburn came home from doing that and was immediately given the task of taking Napoleon to St. Helena. And Cockburn was still running the Royal Navy in the 1840s. So Nelson's legacy is enormously powerful, not just that kind of spiritual legacy, but also the professional legacy. The standards he set were the standards the Navy aspired to right the way through in the 19th century. Even as late as 1904, when Jackie Fisher becomes First Sea Lord, his proudest boast was that he entered the Navy under the guidance of Nelson's last surviving captain. And that wasn't a story he made up, he did. He was entered into the Royal Navy in 1854 by Admiral Sir William Parker, who Nelson had made a frigate captain in 1803, and of whom Nelson thought very highly. So this connection is visceral. It runs right the way through the whole of the 19th century, well into the 20th century. Nelson's name, the names of the ships that he commanded, the battles he fought in, the prizes he took, the places he went to, they form 10% of the Navy's list. There's always an HMS Nelson, there's a Nile, there's an Aboukir, there's a Trafalgar. We tend not to do Copenhagen because we don't want to upset the Danes. But all of the others, they're all there. We're about to launch a new submarine called Agamemnon. Why is it called Agamemnon? Nelson's first battleship. Why otherwise would we name a nuclear submarine after a Mycenaean king? That's the link. And so these names really matter. They connect us back to things that are absolutely central to our sense of self. When we close down Trafalgar Square and use the victory as firewood, you know, we might rewrite our history. But while these things are there, these events and this period have an enormously long legacy. They still exist. They still explain things about who the British are in the 21st century. The fact that we were not occupied or invaded or conquered in the long wars of the Revolution and Napoleon, or the First World War, or the Second World War, sets us apart from every other European country that was engaged in those wars. Our political system survived all of those conflicts without radical change. Nobody else can say that. So we have a very different view of history to the Europeans. And much of this debate that we're having now about the meaning of our decision last year, we're missing huge parts of what that decision was about. We don't have reasons, as in the case of Germany, to want to subsume our national identity into a wider European identity. There are not things in our past that we have to think about in those terms. Everybody else in Europe has got parts of their history, quite recent history, that really don't look desperately good. So we have to be very careful that we're not mistaking decisions we're taking today for simple economic decisions. They're not. They have a much larger dimension. And understanding our past is critical to understanding where we stand in the world and why we stand where we do. That decision was informed by many things, but a sense of who we are and what we've been is a part of that. History matters because history explains how we got here. And our history is not the same as the rest of Europe. The only two countries in the European Union that can say they weren't invaded, occupied, or beaten up in the 20th century is Britain and Sweden. All the others went through periods when they were either invading other people's countries or being invaded and occupied by foreign powers, fighting major civil wars under fascist dictatorship, communist dictatorship. Britain's stability is one of the things that the Europeans so greatly admired, and one of the reasons they regret we leaving.